Good afternoon. You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. I'm Emily Rooney. The Senate finance bill comes down to this, derivatives. And if you are a little foggy on what they are, join the club, but they sure sound like something you'd want your banks to let you know about. Basically, derivatives are agreements between two parties betting on future prices. In the case of the housing market, they were called credit default swaps. That's a derivative where two people bet whether the loans will default. And a few people made big money betting those housing loans would default. Now Congress wants stronger regulations of derivatives. And I'm joined here in the studio by someone who knows a whole lot more than that about them, Bob Posen of MFS Investment Management. He was also Governor Romney's Secretary of Economic Affairs and the author of the recent book, Too Big to Save, How to Fix the U.S. Financial System. Bob, first of all, on the bill itself, you're a supporter.
I'm a supporter of the bill. I think it moves financial regulation forward. It's not perfect. There are lots of compromises, but I think on the whole, it includes a lot of useful and desirable provisions.
On this whole thing with the derivatives and the credit default swaps, I mean, as I said a second ago, it certainly sounds like something that we would want regulated or made transparent or have some clarity to, because this was something that was essentially a secret between the people involved in it. What is the objection to regulating this?
I think there is an agreement on all sides that there needs to be a clearing corporation for standardized contracts in which the party that has the obligation to deliver puts up margins so they'll be sure to be able to deliver. The two controversial issues are, one is, what about customized contracts? Oil companies, airplane companies, these people say they need customized contracts. They don't feel that they should be on a clearing corporation or an exchange. And my view is, it depends on how wide that exemption is.
Give me an example of that.
Well, suppose an airline company wanted to hedge its situation vis-a-vis oil or vis-a-vis currencies. So it might think that because it's such a specialized situation, it needs to have a customized contract that's worked out with a Wall Street firm rather than use a standardized contract. Mm-hmm. Again, a lot of this can be done by standardized. If we're talking about 25% of the contracts, maybe it's reasonable. If we're talking about 75%, it's not reasonable. And in my view, if you have an exempt customized contract, we should still have capital requirements and we should still have reporting to get the transparency. The second big issue is grandfathering. There are a lot of these out there. Now Warren Buffett is pushing very hard to be grandfathered in his company's contracts. Again, if we're talking about a grandfather of a few months, it's one thing. If we're talking about a grandfather of 2 years,
forever,
it's another thing. Back to these two important points. If you have that sort of exemption for an existing contract for a few months, then we should have some reporting and we should have some capital requirements. So I think in both cases, we should be able to reach a compromise. There should be a negotiated settlement as to how big the exemption is for customized and how long it is for grandfathers. Within reason, it can be done. But these things can sometimes become unreasonable.
One of the other issues is this $50 billion set-aside category, so that it's sort of a hedge against future bailouts. But the Republicans are saying that would actually encourage more bailouts if that fund existed.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether they're right, but I believe that the White House has signaled that it's prepared not to pre-fund that resolution authority. There is a general consensus that we need a resolution authority with more tools than just a total bailout or bankruptcy. And this resolution authority would have a number of other tools, such as setting up a transitional conservatorship or selling off some of the assets and retaining the others. If we don't have a pre-fund, and I don't think we will, then there will be authority on the part of the Treasury to assess a special tax, essentially, on other institutions that are considered systemically risky.
So, which is the same thing, in a sense, as setting a
yeah. In both cases, we're really just talking about whether we're going to pre-fund or do it after the fact. The argument by Republicans is pre-funding makes it more likely to use, and I believe that we can do without pre-funding as long as we have a resolution authority and a procedure for taxpayers not to be left holding the bag. And I think we can get those without pre-funding.
I mean, one of the big outrages for the last couple of years has been this whole thing about CEO bonuses and pay. But should the government be in the business of regulating that?
Well, I believe that's the board of directors' job. And unfortunately, as I point out in my book, you know, a lot of boards and financial institutions drop the ball, and that we need a much more expertise board that spends more time and really gets into those bonuses. In the bill, there is a proposal for what's called an advisory vote by shareholders on executive comp. This has been in effect in the UK for the last 3 or 4 years, and it's pretty a pretty mild brew. You have the shareholders vote. Even if they vote a majority, they don't like it, then there's usually some negotiation with the company. In the UK, I think only 5 or 6% of the executive comp arrangements have been even voted down on an advisory basis. So what it really is it polices the outer limits. If there are guaranteed golden parachute payments when people leave or something like that, shareholders will really object. It's just setting the ballpark. In the end, we need good boards. And that's why, you know, I, in my book, argue for boards with much more financial expertise and those who spend much more time on the board process.
Getting back to this derivatives thing again, if banks going forward use the derivative system, they would not get FDIC protection. Is that right?
Well, the proposal, which came very late, remember, this derivatives is a specially complex thing because it comes out of two committees, Senate Banking and Senate Agriculture. So you got to get both committees to agree. At the last moment, the Agriculture came up with this proposal that banks would have to spin off their derivatives. This is sort of like the Volcker proposal that banks would have to spin off proprietary trading.
What does that mean, spin it off?
That means that they couldn't – they'd have to make a totally separate company, would no longer be part of the bank.
I see.
Yeah. I think that proposal is questionable because, first of all, derivatives, proprietary trading, it can be used to reduce risk or increase risk. It depends what you do. For instance, if you're getting Euros from Germany, and you're worried that you want to that the euro U.S. dollar ratio will fluctuate, so you want to hedge your euro risk. Well, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. It reduces risk. You can have a bond or a stock, and you're not sure whether it's going to go down in price, so you buy a put option. It's like an insurance contract. So to say that these things are all speculative is much too broad. And second of all, if we say these things can't be in banks, where are they going to be? Essentially, you're going to recreate a Bear Stearns, which is not an insured institution, and then we'd better be willing not to bail out a big derivatives firm or a big firm that engages in proprietary trading. Remember, Bear Stearns wasn't a bank, and we felt it was so systemically risky, we had to bail it out. And the last point is German banks, French banks, banks in Dubai, they're going to do all these things. And so if we're going to stop the U.S.
banks,
people
just take our business elsewhere.
It's going to move around the world.
Now, this latest thing that Goldman Sachs was accused of, which is essentially a form of a credit default swap, would these proposals, would the Senate banking bill in its current form, would it have prevented Goldman Sachs from doing that? Because there was nothing illegal with what they did,
The allegations against Goldman are essentially that twofold. One is that it should have disclosed that there was a short side as well as a long side on that contract. Well, quite frankly, every sophisticated investor, and those were the only ones involved here, knows that. The second allegation is much more serious. It says that Goldman voluntarily represented that these mortgages that were behind this derivative were selected by a neutral party named ACE and not by anybody else. And if that representation is incorrect, well, they should be held liable. Mm-hmm. If that representation is correct, well, then it's a different story. So it really wasn't whether they were doing a derivative or not. It's just a straight question.
It was the transparency, whether they were telling investors that somebody was betting that they were going to default.
Right. And the investors in this case were all what are called 144A investors. They're all large institutions that sign what's called a big boy letter saying that they're sophisticated, they have access. These aren't even high net worth individuals. These are other banks, insurance companies, et cetera. So this is a negotiated deal, and it's a factual question. Was there a misrepresentation or not? You can't really tell from the complaint.
Some of the things that have come out, we heard Senator Scott Brown on Face the Nation last Sunday saying that in Massachusetts, the passage of this bill would mean between 25 – would cost between 25 and 35,000 jobs in the Mass Mutual industry, I guess. Is that a realistic number? Where does that come from? Is it correct? And by the way, do we need those jobs if it would cost them?
Yeah, I think that number is just taken out of the sky. I really don't think that Scott Brown could show us the statistics.
He says he got them from.
Yeah, but he says he got them from Mass Mutual. Mass Mutual is backing away from it. They're saying, well, that was sort of an idea, maybe this or that. First of all, the only thing that's going to lose jobs is if we require that these things be spun off out of financial institutions, then they may be spun off overseas.
Overseas. Okay.
And if that provisions. If those provisions are not in the bill, as I hope they won't, and leave it more up to the regulators to decide whether particular activities are risky, and if they are, put more capital behind it, then it's hard to see that there's going to be a lot of job change one way or another. So I'm really not sure exactly what Scott is referring to, and I haven't heard anything more in the way of detail. There will be
A lot of people aren't going to lament the loss of a lot of banking jobs. No offense to anybody in the banking industry, but you know, a lot of people feel like these are the guys that are robbing everybody blind in the first place.
Well, most of the banks in Massachusetts are not the banks that were involved in these complicated transactions. There will be higher capital requirements, but those will be for the very largest banks that are systemically risky. And Massachusetts doesn't really have very many of those. Of course, we have branches of those. So I'm not really sure what's being referred to here, and I seriously doubt whether that estimate is correct.
All right. What about these hedge fund rules that are also in the Dodd bill? Because there are hedge funds in Boston.
Yeah. Hedge funds, about one-third of hedge funds now, the managers of hedge funds, are already registered under the Advisors Act with the SEC. The proposal says the hedge fund doesn't have to register, but it says all managers of hedge funds who manage over $100 million or $150 million in assets will have to register with the SEC. This is something that hedge fund managers can live with. It does not limit their investment strategies. It does not prevent them from charging performance fees. But it will subject them for the first time to SEC inspection, so we'll know a little more about what's going on. And they'll have to give a little more disclosure to their clients. I personally, in my book, I've been arguing for years that hedge funds do not have a consistent and standardized methodology of performance reporting, and therefore, as a number of studies have shown, they overstate the returns on average by 2 or 3% a year. So I'd like to see a standardized methodology of reporting. But this is a very light form of regulation, and as I said, a third of hedge fund managers already have voluntarily registered, and I don't see it as a huge thing.
Talking to Bob Posen, chairman of MFS Investment Managers and author of the recent book, Too Big to Save. I want to get your reaction to something that Senator Richard Selby of Alabama said yesterday on Meet the Press.
We've got to end once and for all the casino atmosphere of Wall Street, where they're gambling basically on synthetic ideas and so forth,
and with
somebody else's money, putting banks and our whole banking system at risk and producing nothing.
Bob, Senator Shelby is one of the 41 Republicans, however, who says he's going to vote against the bill. And yet here he is saying that we've got to end the casino atmosphere of Wall Street. Is it strictly a political issue at this point, why the Republicans aren't on board with this?
I think it is very heavily political. They are against certain provisions, as you mentioned, like the pre-funding of that $50 billion resolution fund. But I don't see how the failure to pass any bill is going to help reduce the quote-unquote casino atmosphere of Wall Street. That's a great soundbite, but I'm not sure what it exactly means. And if we are serious about trying to reduce the risk of the system, having a clearing corp for financial derivatives is a very important start, so that we have we know who the parties are, we have them put up margin, we can regulate trading. That's a very important start. And so I think that this bill, while not perfect, moves in the right direction. And doing nothing, I guess I'm at sea as to figure out why nothing is really a good thing.
I think there's also a lot of cynicism out there because regulations have been tried in the past, and it always seems there's a way around everything. That if you start – if this bill addresses certain issues now that we saw happen with the subprime mortgages, that somebody's going to find another way to get around it, to not disclose and make millions of dollars or billions of dollars, and then that will be looked at and have to regulate. It's,
Well, I think it is true that people are pretty creative when you come out with a regulation in one area, then sometimes people figure out how to do things in the other area. But one of the good things about the bill is it sets up a monitoring system for systemic risk. And one of those things the monitoring system should do is look at new instruments that are growing up or things that become high-volume products. And this is the sort of thing that at least we will now focus on. What are the innovations that are really useful? What are the ones that seem potentially destructive? And try to at least quickly figure out whether we should be regulating these new things. We can never anticipate everything, but at least this monitoring system will allow us to focus on the potential problems that are arising every month, every year, as innovation occurs.
All right. If you support the bill, I do. Bob Bozen, chairman of MFS Investment Management, author of the recent book, Too Big to Save. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a short break. When we return, the Worcester Newspaper Guild takes on its parent company, The New York Times. You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. We'll be right back.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Somerset Subaru and the Love Spring event featuring the Subaru Forester, recipient of the 5-star National Highway Traffic Safety Administration Award. Somerset Subaru, here for you, here for life. SomersetAutoGroup.com. And from Simmons Leadership Conference on Friday, April 30th, a day of leadership, motivation, and networking for women seeking to compete in today's changing business climate. Information at simmons.edu/leadership. And from Stoneham Theatre, presenting the classic Lerner and Lowe masterpiece, My Fair Lady, playing now through May 2nd. Tickets and details at 781-279-2200.
Support news and entertainment on 89.7 with a sustaining gift of $5 a month, and WGBH will say thanks over and over again. With our members' discount card, it unlocks 2-for-1 offers at area theaters, incredible deals on Good Eats, and insider discounts at many area shops and retailers. And because sustaining membership automatically renews, those discounts will never expire. Become a WGBH sustainer securely online at WGBH.org.
This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston's NPR station for news and talk all day.
This is Diane Rehm. Join me for conversation about the top stories.
Now, are you finding this to be true, that more people are heading to dangerous places, Robert Reed?
I think so. I mean, people are always wanting to discover something new and travel. And if you
and jazz all night. We are WGBH.
I'm Callie Crossley. Tune in for a wide-ranging conversation. That's today at 1 after the Emily Rooney Show, only here on the new 89.7 WGBH, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.
You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. For rank-and-file newspaper workers, 2009 was the year of the ever-tightening belt. Union members at the Boston Globe accepted millions of dollars in pay and benefit cuts to avoid a threatened closure of the paper. At the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, which, like the Globe, is owned by the New York Times Company, the paper has seen dwindling benefits and downsized newsrooms for the past 4 years. Meanwhile, bonuses were just announced for top executives at the New York Times. New York Times Company Chairman Arthur Sulzberger and President and CEO Janet Robinson took in more than a combined total of $12 million last year. Last month, the Boston Newspaper Guild sent a scathing letter to Robinson and Sulzberger, and this past Friday, members of the Worcester Guild followed suit. Joining me now is Lee Hamill, a reporter at the Worcester Telegram and Gazette and a member of the Worcester Unit Council Local 31041 of the Newspaper Guild. Welcome, Lee. It is hard to imagine that they could, with a straight face, accept those kind of bonuses in the face of what they've asked their rank-and-file workers to do.
Yes, we were unhappy to read about it, given what we've been offered over the last 4 years.
What has happened to you in terms of pay and benefits?
Well, we've been in negotiations. The contract expired in 2007, and we've been in negotiations ever since. And they have been very steadfast in saying they will not give us any pay raises. But on top of that, and that's hard enough, on top of that, they're stripping away many rights that we had and many other benefits, or that they want to do that. And that's why we're in negotiations.
Or is it mostly health benefits and that kind of stuff?
That's part of it. They want to. On health benefits, they want to take away the clause that says substantially equivalent so that they could give us virtually any health plan at all. There would be no limit on what they could take away. And similarly, they want to strip away the caps that we have in place so they could charge us as much as they wanted for those benefits.
I mean, have you done the math on this? What would it mean to your newspaper and your guild if, for instance, Janet and Arthur, what's his name, Punch there, each gave back $500,000 of their bonuses to your newsroom. Let's say you had $1 million. What could you do with that? How far would that go in terms of a raise?
The one math that I've done was the amount of Arthur's increase.
Okay.
And that was he doubled his salary. And in 2009 alone, across the New York Times, they reduced the workforce by 18%. So there's 18% fewer people to do the work.
Across the New York Times, the entire New York Times company, that would include both the Globe and the Worcester and the New York Times itself.
Yes, and some newspapers in the South.
Right.
They've got
so they reduced its workforce by 18%.
Yes, this is the period over which he got the pay raise. And his pay raise, not his salary, just his raise, would be enough to pay 75 employees.
So what was the raise, you know?
It went from $3 million to $6 million, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, not that they are obligated to respond to you in any way, but do you expect them to?
To the best of my knowledge, they haven't responded to the Globe yet. And the guild at the Globe wrote them a letter, I would say, a month ago.
Talking to Lee Hamill, reporter at the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. What do you do there, Lee? What do you cover?
I'm a reporter. I recently got a new assignment. I'm a general assignment reporter.
Mm-hmm. So you cover everything.
Right.
And the paper serves about, what, 71,000, 72,000?
Daily 71,000, Sunday 81,000.
And do you feel like the paper has been diminished as a result of the cutbacks?
We've had to make some very, very difficult choices, and it certainly has. They've done some things that they didn't do before, but there's been a tremendous loss of space. There's not as much space to write stories or to write as long. The stories are much shorter, and there are fewer of them.
Do you feel like you've lost, that you've missed stories, that you're not as aggressive with covering, I don't know, City Hall, government?
There's no question there are fewer things we can do. There's fewer things that we have space to do, and there's fewer people to do them.
Your company is also going to try something new, which is charging for online content. How do you think that's going to go down?
I don't know. The Times itself is planning to do that,
yes.
And we just announced that we're going to do it as well. The details of not many details have been announced. In the past, I think prior to 4 years ago, they did try charging for content.
Yeah, they did.
And it didn't work very well. I think they're going to do it in a different way now, but I don't know the details of it.
You know, we do a lot of discussion about newspapers and the news business in general, when I'm a big supporter of it, and I think there's always going to be a need for content gatherers, reporters, people go out and get the news, deliver it. I mean, people think that, oh, I'll just turn to the web, without realizing that all news has to start somewhere. There's an original news gatherer. Most of them are in the newspaper business. Is it still valuable to be a newspaper guy?
Oh, it's the best job in the world. I mean, I love it. I've done it for 38 years. It's just the best thing in the world. But if you don't have the space to run your stuff and you don't have enough people to go out and gather it, it's hard.
What do you think the main mission is here? Do you think the New York Times Company wants to bust the Newspaper Guild?
They're certainly not crazy about us.
They weren't crazy about the Boston Newspaper Guild either.
Right. I mean, for example, the Guild has been around. We started around 1992. It took until I think about 2002 just to get a contract. And they, up until now anyway, have refused, for example, to do dues checkoff. So we have to collect our own dues. They say, no, we're not interested in helping collect dues. And so, you know, they're not too crazy
about
the Guild.
Oh, I see. So they don't take it out of your paycheck. You have to
right,
do that separately.
The Guild has to go to each member and get it. It wouldn't cost the company anything to do it.
What do you get for your dues?
I'm sorry?
What do you get for your dues, honestly?
We get representation. We get a feeling that, you know, we have a voice. And more and more and as much as that's a great, you know, as time goes on, we feel like we have less and less say over what we do, and our opinions are cared about less. And so the Guild gives us a feeling that there's somebody to speak for us.
I mean, this is the Guild that's going after the New York Times now. But, I mean, they're not going to respond. They're probably not going to move off the demands that they've got on the table with you now.
Well, I'd like to think I'm certain that Arthur Sulzberger and Janet Robinson are decent people. And they preside over a newspaper that does terrific things.
They do, yeah.
So their editorials are great. The values that you read about in the New York Times and in our paper are good. But I think we need to wake them up a little bit. You can't go around telling everybody else they have to act justly and that they're exempt from doing it themselves.
Talking to Lee Hamill, reporter at the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, a member of the Worcester Unit Council of the local newspaper guild. What do you think they have in mind here? What's their master plan? I mean, they are taking salary increases and bonuses themselves. Last year when they were forcing the Boston Globe to give all those give backs, they were saying it was a shared pain, but you don't see the share. I don't see the sharing either.
It's hard to see. I don't know what they've got in mind. I can't fathom what they were thinking when they said, you know, we're entitled to double our salary and you should work for the same thing you've been working for the last 4 years.
What about the reporters at the New York Times itself? Are you aware of what their deal is? Have they been getting increases?
I'm not familiar with the Times, no.
I haven't seen anything from them at all, you know, they were also, I thought, very, very slow. The New York Times was very slow to cover the story of the Boston Globe itself. It was barely a mention. Finally, after the public editor, Clark Hoyt, got on their case, there was a few more stories. But it was as if the Boston Globe had gone out of business. It wouldn't have mattered to the readers. Certainly not to the readers of the New York Times.
Maybe
they're doing the same thing to you.
Yeah. We'll see. But I don't think it's their favorite story.
No. Well, just back to their response for a minute. I mean, because, you know, it seems just on the face of it sort of, you know, shocking that they could take those kinds of salaries. If you don't get a response from them, what will you do?
We are in negotiations, and I mean, that's the proper place for us to be talking. And, you know, we hope to change their mind. They've been very, very, very slow to respond with anything. They've recently moved a little bit, but it's almost laughable how little the progress has been made.
They originally said that the Boston Globe was not for sale. Then they made it clear that the Boston Globe was for sale, and there were a couple of interested parties. They have since taken the Boston Globe off the market, and they claim that the Telegram and Gazette is also no longer for sale. Do you believe that?
As far as I don't have any other information. I mean, there were active negotiations between some very well-respected local people in Worcester, and I don't know what happened, but that they announced that's not going to happen. I think part of this is the Worcester Telegram throughout all this, unlike the Boston Globe, unlike the New York Times, I think, the Worcester Telegram has been profitable, they've told us. You know, there's some value in the Telegram. Some people think financially even more so than the Globe.
Would you like to see it sold?
I'd like to see us get a fair contract. If we can get a fair contract from the New York Times, then I'm very proud to be part of the New York Times family. But if they don't want to treat their employees right, then, gee, I'd like to work for somebody who does think more of us.
The Boston Globe Union did sort of play a game of chicken with them. They voted the contract down, and then the Times Company instantly instituted these draconian pay cuts. I think, if I recall, it was 25% pay cut or something like that.
23.
That went on for several weeks while the union went back to the table, or forced them back to the table. They eventually relented and went back to the table. Would you be willing to take those kinds of steps?
Well, I'm glad to say they're not asking us to take 23% pay cuts. They're asking us to stay just where we are. So I don't know how it's going to work out. We think that given that they've reduced our newsroom more and more and more, so that those of us who are left have to do more and more and more, we'd like them to show the appreciation for the additional work that we have to do. We're glad to do it. But we think if Arthur is worth double his salary, I wouldn't mind taking a 5% pay raise.
Or even two.
or whatever, you know.
All right. I've been talking to Lee Hamill, a reporter at the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. And they are unhappy over the fact that Arthur Sulzberger and Janet Robinson took $12 million increases last year, while they're asking the paper and the people, employees there, to take cuts or no pay raises. Thanks for joining us here today, Lee.
Thanks for
having
me. Good
luck with your battle.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we return, what to do about extreme behavior in small children. You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Samets Blackstone Associates, brand strategy, design, and digital media. 30 years of helping mission-driven organizations navigate change. You can follow them on Twitter at SAMETZ. And from Huntington Theater Company, presenting Prelude to a Kiss, which explores the power of love and nature of commitment in a breathtaking and life-affirming comedy directed by Peter Dubois, May 14th through June 13th, huntingtontheater.org. And from Russell's, a family gardening tradition for over 130 years. Flowers, plants, trees, shrubs, locally made gift specialties, and more. Russell's Garden Center, Route 20 in Wayland. For hours and information, russellsgardencenter.com.
I'm Callie Crossley. From the bus stop to the boardroom, we'll bring you a wide-ranging conversation that taps into the talk of your town. We want to hear from you, too. So call in and become a part of the daily discussion. That's today at 1, right after The Emily Rooney Show, only here on the new 89.7 WGBH, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.
this program is right up your alley, then don't miss what's coming up next. Stocked with news and entertainment from NPR, the BBC, and our own local productions here at WGBH, the new 89.7 is your source for what's happening around the corner and across the globe. Keep listening to the new 89.7 WGBH and hear the power of public support.
This is 89.7
WGBH, Boston's NPR station.
For trusted voices.
And local conversation.
With fresh air.
And the Emily Rooney Show.
The new 89.7 WGBH.
You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. In an article in yesterday's Boston Globe magazine, freelance writer Linda Wertheimer examines extreme behavior among preschoolers. She reports that a Yale study in 2005 found that 3- and 4-year-olds were being expelled from publicly funded preschools for behavior problems at an alarming rate. Linda Wertheimer is here. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You describe various scenarios involving very young children, you know, 2, 3, 4. And a lot of it sounds like behavior that I've witnessed. I'm sure you witnessed. I can remember incidents very similar to that with my own child. Has something changed, or are we just recognizing it as being a behavior problem that's more serious than we used to think it was?
I don't think anything's changed in terms of how the typical preschooler behaves. By the way, I have a 2-year-old, so
okay.
I certainly have seen some of the behaviors in this article with my 2-year-old. The difference is there is more awareness. There are also a lot more kids in preschool than there was even a decade ago. States are funding preschool more than they used to. So with more kids in there, you're starting to see more of these problems. And the key is like, while we may all see these behaviors with our own toddlers, there's a difference. With these kids, it happens a lot more often. And it tends to be more extreme when they do act out.
So, yeah, describe it. You're talking about temper tantrums that go on, that are prolonged, or
they can be 2 hours.
Repetitive. Often over the same issues, like clothing. I mean, that was a big one with my kid,
yes.
What she would wear. But just every day and
– everyday tantrums. In terms of the kids who are getting expelled, hitting frequently, biting frequently, kicking frequently, also fleeing the classroom or wherever they're supposed to be frequently, to the point where, you know, usually you have at least 2 adults in the room with a class. But that can be difficult if every time, you know, that this kid's always running off.
All right. This is good. How do you tell the difference between a kid who's got these kind of behavior problems and it's a mental disorder versus bad parenting?
Excellent question. And I interviewed Joshua Sparrow, who co-wrote a book with the famous Terry Brazelton, and he talked about the fact that it's hard. I mean, there's a huge range of what's normal in toddlerhood. And the key word what they say is it's just happening a heck of a lot more often than with a normal kid. It is disrupting the parent's life. It's disrupting school life. Bad parenting versus the child, it meets in the middle somewhere. Usually, one of the things they said is research is showing that a lot of it is how the kid is born. And that the parents may aggravate the situation.
What do you mean, how it's born?
When the child comes out,
yeah.
The child may be wired a little more differently to be more difficult than another child. But then the parent can then aggravate the situation. So that may – someone will say, well, wow, that's a bad parent. And they say it's somewhere in between. Parents can aggravate it. But if a child is
– because I noticed one of the people you profiled in the piece yesterday was the grandmother.
Yes.
And not the parent of the
yes.
toddler. And she sounded like the primary caregiver. Well, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. Where are the parents? And is this kid suffering from something other than a behavioral disorder?
That is a very extreme situation. In that situation, I mean, I have 3 very different scenarios in there. That child was taken from his parents' home and sent to live with grandma.
Because?
Because both parents ended up in jail on drug charges.
So they were abusive, probably.
Abusive was not physically abusive.
Well, emotionally,
it could have been emotionally. There could have been some
neglect. So the kid had problems.
The way the grandmother was describing it to me, the way the social worker was, there was no structure in the house. He'd be up till 10 o'clock at night. He may have seen some abusive stuff between his parents, but as far as I know, he was never physically abused. But he is definitely on the high end of the scale in terms of the situations that happened to him. I would call him the type of case that always happens.
Yes. He wasn't born with some kind of a mental disorder.
No.
This kid was put into circumstances that made life tough for him.
Right. And what made this story interesting to me was the situation of the other kids, because they're more normal situation. Some of them had the stay-at-home mom. Some of them didn't. Middle, upper-class families. I had a whole range.
I'm talking to Linda Wertheimer, who had a piece in yesterday's Globe magazine entitled Little Kids, Big Problems. Linda, I could not help but notice, I didn't see drugs mentioned anywhere in your piece, since that's such a huge controversy right now with that Rebecca Riley case.
Yes. And we talked about that. Drugs are not something being used with any of these kids. They're actually not at the extreme that anyone would be prescribing drugs.
But it sounds like they could have been if that doctor from Tufts had gotten a hold of one of these kids. She probably would have been putting them on clonidine or one of those things.
You know, I don't know. I mean, they could also end up for special ed for years to come. There's a lot of things that could have happened if they were – these problems were caught so early. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of these problems were caught early enough that they hadn't reached such a point. Mm-hmm. That they might end up in a psychiatrist's office being medicated.
You talk about a couple of facilities where these kids got some help, and so did the parents.
Yes.
In terms of how to interact with these kinds of kids. There's some television show where the nanny comes in and, you know,
and
takes
the super nanny?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Never seen it.
I have caught it sort of passing by, and some of it seems obvious, the way you would interact or sort of but not all of it.
Yes. Well, there's two things here. You have the early childhood mental health consultants. And in the Worcester program that I talk a lot about, there's this woman, Kelly Grattan, who's based in the program. And she is both coaching the parents and working with the child. And one of the things that she's trying to do is to get the parents to understand the child may not be doing this on purpose. The child simply may not know how to act normally. Among his or her peers, and may just be behind, not necessarily because of a developmental delay problem, but just behind somehow in how to behave. And so what she does is she works with the parents on how to meet the child halfway. And then she works with the child to try and help that child learn how to express his or her feelings. So that's part one of it. Part two of it is with this woman, Patty Marquis. She's a social worker out of Concord. What she does, and she does this workshop twice a year with parents who feel like their child is out of control. And she does, her focus is entirely on what can you do as parents to improve the situation at home? How can you be more empathetic about your child? Mm-hmm. You know, how can you rein in your anger?
All right. I'm talking to Linda Wertheimer, who wrote a piece for yesterday's Globe magazine, Little Kids, Big Problems. What are some of the techniques?
There were several different things that Patty talked about. Let me just think of an simple example. There's a family that I talk about. I think it's the first family in the story, the kid who knocked the toy off the birthday cake. He's now 7 years old. When he started first grade, he came home and was pretty out of control. And mom wanted to take him to do activities or this sort of things. And because of what she learned in the training, she took kind of a step back and tried to figure out, well, what's going on in my little boy's head? What can I do so that I'm not making the situation worse? Well, one of the things she learned, which to me sounds like common sense, but it's true, is ask the boy, what do you want to do when you get home from school? Give him maybe two choices. And what happened is he wanted to stay home, not run around and do stuff, have his own little space. And then he was fine, you know, maybe to do something with the family, and his behavior would be better. Hmm. So a lot of it is sheer common sense.
But it's not reasoning with the kid.
It's not reasoning with the kid. And it's not thinking that your kid somehow is out to get you or out to control you. You know, I can't think – my 2-year-old this morning was fine with me putting on his little onesie, but he didn't want the shirt over his head. Well, I didn't think he's trying to be difficult with mommy. Yeah. I just thought, you know, he may just not want the shirt over his head. And we just kind of kept talking. And eventually I got the shirt over his head.
Oh, so yeah, he just wanted to put on a shirt. Clothing seems to be a big issue with little kids.
It's about independence.
They know what they want. Mm-hmm. They know what they want to put on or what they don't.
Well, and a lot of two-year-olds in particular generally want to walk around just in their diaper.
Yeah.
3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds, it may be more of an issue if they want to do it themselves. Or they want to do it when they want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the drugs issue here, because I kept sort of looking for it, expecting that you might bring it up.
I mean,
what did anybody tell you about that, about diagnosing children at this age, 2, 3, 4, with things like bipolar disorder?
Well, so the woman that I spoke with probably the most about that was the early childhood mental health consultant in Worcester. I don't think she had any children that actually met that definition. If she thinks that there's a child that needs something more than she can handle.
Does she think it's possible to diagnose somebody at that age?
We didn't actually have that kind of discussion because it wasn't coming up with these kids.
She probably doesn't.
I don't want to speak for her. But everyone I talked to said they weren't using phrases like bipolar with these kids. I mean, what they were using phrases like, a lot of these kids, for a variety of reasons, environmental reasons at home. One child did have a sensory processing disorder that I describe in the story.
Oh, yeah. That was curious. I've never heard of that.
I hadn't either.
Talk about that.
Yeah.
Sensory processing disorder. You know,
there's
always something new on the horizon there.
Yes. You know? And it kind of reminded me when ADD first came out. And a lot of us were like, well, what the heck is that?
And then everybody has it.
Yeah. This one, it's a very complicated definition, and I'll try and make it really simple.
Sorry
about that. What this one is about is the child may be protesting putting clothes on because she doesn't like the feel of the material. They're much more sensitive to anything sensory, whether it's you sitting across from me, you're too close, or the feel of the clothing. They also sometimes have physical delays somehow related to sensory issues in the body. It's a very complicated diagnosis, and this girl was showing several of the symptoms related to it. And it's not a drug that you give to them to cure it. It's physical therapy. It's occupational therapy.
Is it a form of autism or is it?
No, it's not. It's something different. Mm-hmm. And there is a, I think it's called the Sensory Processing Disorder Foundation. There's a whole website now that tells you all about it. And I did check with some experts. Is this for real? And they said yes.
What about autism? Did any of your experts talk about that? About, you know, some they see these children so young. Some of them probably haven't been diagnosed with anything. I mean, people don't know what to look for. I mean, how do you sort out some of these, you know, extreme behavioral problems versus something like autism, which is far more serious?
Well, there's no question that if a child has autism, that they might be more apt to show severe behavior. And I think they said they have had some kids that fit in that, and they send them to a specialist. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that I'm speaking, that I spoke to, they don't diagnose autism. They then have to send the child to someone else to diagnose it. There certainly are kids that fall into that. You would hope that they wouldn't end up being expelled, that they would be sent to a special program.
A couple of weeks ago, we had Judith Warner from the New York Times on the show. She's written a book called We've Got Issues. She started out – I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
She started out as kind of a naysayer, a disbeliever that kids could be diagnosed with these kinds of disorders so young, mm-hmm. or that it was ever appropriate to prescribe some of these mind-altering psychotic drugs, essentially, for these kids. But she turned around on this completely and is really now a believer that we're better off now that we intervene so early with these kids. And it sounds like that's what some of your providers there were finding as well.
Definitely. That definitely is the thrust. I had skepticism. I've covered education for probably 20-odd years and was the Globe's education editor before I left. And a story that I did fairly early in my career was about attention deficit disorder. And a lot of kids were being overdiagnosed with it.
Oh, so see, now that's another thing that Judith Warner claims that's a statistic that is no longer real. She says, well, there was no overdiagnosis of it and there wasn't a run on Ritalin. And I'm saying there was because, you know, when my kid was in school, you know, 50% of the kids were on Ritalin or some form of ADD drugs or whatever. And it doesn't seem it's quite as prevalent now. I could be wrong.
I mean, this is an opinion not based totally in fact, but I would agree with you on that. I mean, mm-hmm. I based on what I heard from teachers that I was interviewing, even from parents, there was some overdiagnosis when ADD first came out. It doesn't mean that a lot of kids who have it don't have it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they were just exhibiting behavior like some of the kids in the story who didn't have ADD.
So I'm talking to Linda Wertheimer, wrote a piece for yesterday's Boston Globe magazine, Little Kids, Big Problems. I mean, where do parents go? If you got your kid in a regular public school or a kindergarten or a preschool and gets expelled or gets a note home saying this kid's got serious issues, what's somebody supposed to do?
You know, I asked somebody that at my son's daycare center this morning because they also have a preschool. And I certainly talked about that with the people in my article. If your child gets expelled, start with your public school system. They have special education services. Get your child evaluated. See if there is some kind of problem. And then they can possibly end up in a public preschool that you don't have to pay for. Mm-hmm. That's one idea. Also look for workshops in your community on this subject.
Yeah, because I noticed there was some small pot of money that the state sets aside for these kinds of things, but it was just a little over $1 million, which would seem right. For the entire state, which would sort of seem to hardly cover it.
Only 80 cities and towns are receiving that money right now. So a parent would probably have to fork out their own money to get their child evaluated unless they can get it done through the public school system.
Yeah, because that's the way it was when my kid was going through all that stuff. I mean, you did it yourself.
Yes.
And then if you wanted, you know, if you wanted to take it to the next step, it was all up to the parent.
Right. And now at least I think, you know, you can check with – I don't think. I know. You can check with the public school system. They're now – they do evaluations of kids. And in fact, in Lexington where I live, they have a public preschool there that serves kids with problems.
Talking to Linda Wertheimer, whose piece in the Boston Globe magazine yesterday was Little Kids, Big Problems. Are these people telling you, the experts that you talked about, that there are more kids with these extreme problems?
It's a tough question to answer because nobody's ever really documented it. Even the expulsion data that I was looking at.
That's way up. I was stunned by that.
Well, but it's a one-year snapshot.
Yeah.
So that just stunned people because they hadn't
seen
it.
Maybe they're just more intolerant. So, you know, we're not dealing with your Brett kid. We've got a waiting line, of, you know, a mile long. Get this one out. We'll get somebody else in.
I'm not sure I would totally agree with that. I think we have more kids in preschool. More kids in daycare.
And there's a demand for these things.
And there's
as
a
we
demand
know.
For these things.
So if somebody's
so
a problem,
seeing,
they're more likely to get thrown out.
We're seeing the problems more than we would have 10 to 20 years ago simply because there are more kids out there with caregivers in a more public type of setting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Fascinating. Been talking to Linda Wertheimer, who wrote a piece for yesterday's Boston Magazine, Little Kids, Big Problems. Thanks for being here with us today, Linda. All right, that's going to do it for us this afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow at noon. In the meantime, tune into Greater Boston tonight at 7. Selling sex on Craigslist, should it be regulated? We'll have that story and more tonight at 7. The Emily Rooney Show is a production of 89.7 WGBH, Boston's NPR station for news and culture. On the web at wgbh.org/Emily Rooney. The Callie Crosley Show is coming up next. I'm Emily Rooney. Have a great afternoon.